Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Smarks and Stripes podcast. We cover every bump, every spot, and chat with all the talent around the world of wrestling. Here's your host, Bill Matz, former WWE referee Kevin Keenan, and Eric Golden.
What's going on, everyone? Come on in, sit down, and enjoy some Smarks and Stripes. Former WWE referee Kevin Keenan with you, flying solo today for the very first time. Today we are turtleless, we are matchless, but you know what they say, the more Keenan, the better. Hey, guys, well, look, today on Smarks and Stripes, we have former WWE superstar Simon Dean, and I got to give you guys a little bit of a full disclosure here. Simon Dean, the former Nova, Mike Bucci, as we know him, he's someone who's been like a brother to me since 2005. Yes, he was my boss in developmental, but I've learned so much about wrestling and life from him, and we're going to get into everything in his career. He's got an incredible story from being a manager at Wendy's. Yes, he was in the fast food industry while working his way up into ECW, being successful there, becoming a star and working all over the world right after that company closed, and then finding his way to the WWE to become a WWE superstar and later on an executive in the company. This is a must-listen interview. He does not hold back at all. Enjoy Simon Dean. Well, I'm sure you're in a good mood as we record this, the day following week one, a 35-17 Cowboys win, you dirty scumbag Cowboys fan. What's up, man?
Lifelong brother. Look, man, it's about time I did your podcast. You've asked me to do this about 10 times, and I kept either forgetting or just not calling you to do it.
No, you just didn't do it.
Much like Trump. Probably like how Tommy had. Did Tommy do it yet or no?
Tommy did my last one. He hasn't done this one. He has. We're trying to get him into the studio to come in next time he's in for House of Hardcore.
Look, brother. But yesterday was a true glorious day. What was incredible was watching Rain Dakota Prescott, who everybody has buried since last season. He can't throw. He can't do this. He can't do that. He looked like Joe Montana yesterday. So all you Eagles fans out there, all you marks that are listening to this, the man played incredible. He's a true leader. He's worth every penny that Jerry's going to pay him. He's going to win Super Bowls. And when he plays in it, I will be there, Kevin Keenan. I will call you from the field when we win and when the confetti is on me.
25 for 32, Dak yesterday was 405 yards, 4 touchdowns. Is he a top 5 quarterback by the end of this year?
Definite top 10 for sure. I would say top 5. I mean, here's the thing. I would say top 5 of the young guys. Because your Drew Brees, I was saying to somebody yesterday, within the next 3 to 4 years, Drew Brees, Ben Roethlisberger, Eli Manning, Phillip Rivers, Tom Brady are all going to be gone. You're going to have this next wave of guys, Jared Goff, Carson Wentz, Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston, they're coming up at the end of the rookie deals. They're not gonna lead the next wave of big time NFL young quarterbacks. So Dak, fantasy wise, if he plays like he did yesterday, he'll be the MVP of the league.
So Zeke gets his money. Zeke gets paid before week one. 13 carries, 53 yards, and a touchdown. What was your biggest takeaway from Zeke yesterday?
It was the gimmick of having Zeke there. Even though Zeke trained in Cabo, which, by the way, I think Jerry's going to set up a training camp in Cabo next year to get the results that Zeke had. I mean, he was literally there 4 yards a carry. There's no way he was going to touch that ball 20 to 25 times yesterday. He didn't need to. Just like you or us back in the day. We're wrestling and training and classes and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't matter. Once you get an actual match, it's totally different. So he got his legs underneath him yesterday. And also, too, the flow of the game was going to dictate how Zeke was used yesterday. Next up is Washington this week. who gave you guys a nice little run for the money yesterday.
Only in the first half.
Well, the Redskins were ahead. Well, here's the thing. Division games, it's always, it could be a toss-up. So it just is what it is with division games. But then we have Miami week 3, and then the real test comes week 4 against the Saints. In theory, I want to see what the Saints put on paper tonight. But put on the screen, rather. But Zeke, for what he was yesterday, looked great. He was running hard, breaking tackles, picking up downs. He caught the ball well. And then he didn't even play in the fourth quarter. So he had 13 carries, but he never touched the ball in the fourth quarter. Pollard did. They didn't need him to. It would have been using like a bazooka on a nap. At that point, it was over. It was take away the splash play by Saquon Barkley, who's a great back, don't get me wrong. But that's the Barkley gimmick. He hits a couple big splash plays, and then the rest of it's 2 or 3 yards here or there, and the Giants can't do anything. The Giants are going to wind up burning his best years out behind a terrible team. Did you watch that game yesterday?
I watched very little of it. We're going to move on here, but real quick, before we get to anything that has to do with wrestling, I need your official Cowboys prediction right here on the Smarks and Stripes podcast. What are the Cowboys going to do this year? Give me a record. Give me a number. How far are they going? What are you seeing?
You already know it's going to come out of my mouth. We're going to win a minimum of 11 games. Ugh. We're going to be the NFC representative in the Super Bowl.
God.
And we're going to win the 6th Super Bowl to the Dallas Cowboys this year. We will win number 6.
That is absolutely terrible to hear. I don't see any of that.
Why?
I don't see any of that happening, but we can bring you back on should any of that happen down the line. Let's jump into some wrestling.
Let me make you public right now. What's the Eagles? Go with the Eagles right now. What are the Eagles going to do?
12-4.
12-4?
12-4.
Do they make the divisional round or the championship game or what?
I'm undecided. I'm undecided on that right now. I'll give you a record of 12-4. I need to see a little more just to see, just a little more play. We could win the Super Bowl this year, but I'm not willing to hang my hat on that yet.
Does Wentz make it through the whole season? He hasn't in the last 4 or 5 years of his career going back to college.
This is the year he makes it through the whole season. Yes, absolutely. He plays 16 games this year.
Look, even as an Eagle hater, I was very disappointed to see what happened to Nick Foles yesterday. I felt bad for Nick Foles. I did.
I mean, 6 to 8 weeks, broken clavicle. I mean, we've seen guys with broken clavicles in wrestling. I've never remembered them being back in 8 weeks.
I lived it 3 years ago. That's the year before Dak came on board. The year before Dak came on board, Tony Romo broke his collarbone like in week 2 against the Eagles because he got cheated and slammed to the ground.
Yeah.
And then he came back after 8 weeks on Thanksgiving against Carolina, and he rebroke it that same game. And then he was out the rest of the season. He was never the same.
All right. Well, we got your official Cowboys prediction. Let's transition over to some wrestling. You don't do many of these. These days,
no.
Very rare appearances. Don't do many interviews. You've chosen to keep your hand on the pulse of the business, but not very active outside of a few things a year. Why has that been?
You know who the only person I really talk to about wrestling every now and then kind of is?
Who's that?
You. That's it. Here's the thing, man. For me, I had a career that exceeded all expectations I ever could have hoped for. I worked really, really hard, did the best I could, made some friends along the way, some lifelong friends like you and a few others. There was a whole host of others that I never liked being around. Good experiences, bad experiences. It was a part of my life that was great. I just don't dwell in it. I've always wanted to do more. Just constantly reinventing yourself, pushing forward, accomplishing more. I'm a dad now. I have a great job. I do a ton of charity work. Do as much as I can. And just wrestling for me just isn't what it used to be. I'm 47 years old and was in the business when I was 19. And through ECW, WWE, all the other stuff I ever did, it was just, there comes a point where you just kind of look around and say, hey, it's not the same thing I fell in love with. It's a different sport. It's a different entity. The couple appearances or things that I do per year now, a lot of the guys either, it is what it is, this for a fact, they either have never heard you before, they don't know you, or just different vibe in the locker rooms, and it's just a different aura about it. Not everyone's like that. I mean, there's some people that are running some good stuff, and those are the ones I kind of do some stuff for. But I wouldn't care, Keenan, if I ever stepped foot in a wrestling ring ever again. I think I did 3 or 4 things this year total. Speaking and they're real close to the house, and that's it. I mean, we got some stuff next year, probably. We got the video game coming out we're part of. I have a couple other things I've got approached with I'll take part in. But other than that, I just like you. You moved on and accomplished a lot more in the real world. And, you know, the Kevin Fertigs of the world, Matt Morgans, all of us who used good old wrestling to move forward and do something different, I think that's to be commended because we didn't get stuck in the bubble.
You spoke a couple seconds ago about a different vibe and a different aura, and there certainly is that in the wrestling world today. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on a company that's getting a ton of publicity right now, making quite a bit of noise, only been in existence roughly 6 months, and that being AEW. Obviously, you and I know a ton of the guys on the inner workings of this company, and given the experience that some of them have, what do you think? I mean, do they have a chance to become a threat to the WWE?
Well, here's the thing on AEW. Now, this is a smart podcast, right? So I'm assuming that most of the people that listen to this kind of know what's up, or they think they know what's up for the most
part. They think they know what's up, yeah.
Kevin Keenan, did I not tell you about the rumbling of a brand new wrestling company that was going to come out? I told you about Tony Khan.
Mm-hmm.
I told you about the financial backers.
Mm-hmm.
I told you how it was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I told you virtually everything about that. Would you be fair to say almost a year before that launched?
Yeah, roughly a year or so. It was right in around that time. I remember having this conversation with you a couple times.
truth be told, my interest was piqued on it. I had discussions with a couple people about it. Never really went anywhere. And I'm glad I wouldn't trade anything I do now for anything in the wrestling industry. I just wouldn't. But for the guys, Frankie, Daniels, Cody, his wife, the Bucks, all those guys, I hope they make $10 million a piece. I hope they make zillions. Do I think that there's a massive appetite out there for professional wrestling these days? I don't know. There's so much. Every time I turn around, there's another streaming network launching. There's all kinds of content on TV. The entertainment dollar is stretched further than ever. People are constantly comparing wrestling now to the ratings of, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the Attitude Era, the 80s. There was a lot less entertainment options back then. There just was. So, not sporting, anything. There's only so many hours in a day you can commit to watching a show or a program or a hobby or whatever it may be. Do I hope it works? Do I hope it works? Yeah, I do, because it's another place for everybody to work. You know, you got to remember something. I was part of a company that went out of business in early 2000, and when that happened, a whole lot of people were never really seen on a national scale ever again. A lot of careers ended, and there's a lot of people in AEW. They have a niche roster. They have a very specific type of performer they're looking for, I think. They definitely have I'm sure there's a great camaraderie there. It looks like everybody there gets along, they're cool, they're friendly, and with those guys in the office positions, I think they've been told no enough times, they've been turned down, they've been denied, so they know how to maybe treat people a little bit differently than they could have gotten somewhere else. Is it going to have blockbuster ratings on TNT? And I don't know. I mean, I was part of ECW and was on TNN, and the network didn't really do anything to promote it. I mean, you didn't even know it was on TNN. They were more worried about roller games. ECW was nothing more than an experiment to show that a wrestling show could work on TNN, because they got rid of ECW as soon as they could, and they brought WWE was on TNN for a while. Remember?
I do remember. We're going to get into ECW here in a little bit. But with AEW being, I mean, let's be honest here, virtually unknown at this current point in time, outside of a couple shows, and they're selling some buildings out, and they seem like they're having some good success right out from Jump Street. Does it surprise you at all from what we've seen so far that the WWE is kind of selling them as much as they are, with answering them by putting NXT directly opposite of them on TNT on Wednesday nights?
Not at all. Yeah, I know how it works behind the scenes, or at least I did. I mean, obviously, I've been there in 12 years. But it doesn't surprise me at all. They want to remain number one. I don't think they're threatened by it. I think it's more of a, we'll show them. And they could have put the NXT show on anytime. They could have put that on USA whenever they wanted. They could have done it anytime, any day, any channel, whenever they want. They chose to do it now. And I believe it's going to be on a couple weeks before the AEW show launches.
NXT will be they'll get full 2 weeks on USA before TNT.
How many?
NXT will be on a full 2 weeks on USA before AEW debuts
on TNT.
You watch
the wheel out what they do on those 2 weeks. They're going to load that thing to the gills. And it just, you know, again, I don't know. You got Impact out there and Ring of Honor and a couple others and place for guys to work and the boys. And I want AEW to succeed. Because, again, anything personally that Frankie Kazarian is part of, I hope it's the greatest thing that ever happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
Frankie's my guy, and he always will be. And I'm cool with Daniels. I like the Bucks. Kenny's a good dude. Cody's great. I want to see them make some money. You know, they're at least trying. I'll give them that. You know, there's been, look, man, I'm not an idiot. I hear a lot of negativity, too. I've had two dozen people actually reach out and say, this sucks, the money mark thing, it's going to be this, it's going to be that, blah, blah, blah. You know what, man? Keep your opinion yourself. Nobody wants it. You're not part of it. They don't want you part of it. And just wish them all the best and hope it works. That's what I would say. I mean, I hope it does.
You know, but to that point, there are a few detractors going in to AEW as a whole. And for me, you know, a big problem that they have going in is very few guys know how to actually work live TV. And you know better than anybody what it's like to show up a building at, you know, 1 p.m., be told you have 10 minutes, and by the time you get ready to go out 7 minutes later or 7 hours later, you're told you have, you know, 3 minutes, 90 seconds, whatever it is. But yet you as Simon Dean and so many of the other guys and girls who have worked for that company always knew how to accomplish the business and, you know, get done what was needed. Whether it was promoting a pay-per-view, selling this or that, it didn't matter what it was. You guys always knew. This will no doubt happen when AEW lands on TNT. And if you're not Cody, if you're not Jericho, if you're not Dustin or you're not Spears, you've never really been put in that position. If you were to give these guys a crash course on working on TV, what would that sound like?
Well, good news is they have Dean and Arn there. So here's the thing. If it's going to be, is the show going to be broadcast live every week or is it taped?
Every week, live.
So if it's live, they don't have a safety net, they're going to have to work on that. They're not going to be able to go out. First of all, there's no way on a weekly television show, and I know this because in ECW, this is kind of what we did. There's no way on a weekly television show every single week you can go out there and wrestle the style of matches that these guys are having on the pay-per-views right now. Because it's just not, I don't think it's physically sustainable. Because somebody will die. The bar just keeps getting pushed more and more and more, and somebody's going to kill somebody. So they have to dial it back a little bit less is more. They'll have, I know they will do that. Cody's smart. They got, like you said, Jericho, a bunch of other guys. They got Dean there, Arn there. I think what they could possibly do is they'll probably be a little bit, I would be a little bit more heavy-handed with the agenting early on and be like, hey, and have the agents right there. So when, and I don't know these guys, I'm just throwing two names out there. Darby Allin goes out there and wrestles against Jungle Boy, and they're supposed to have 8 minutes. As they're about to go to the curtain, and Dean Malenko's right there and says, look, this show's running long. You have to cut out 3 minutes. Jungle Boy, cut out the beginning of this, and you guys go right to the heat, start with this. Okay, Dean, that's what we'll do. That's what I think they should probably do. But again, if they structure these matches with the guys and they make them adhere to their times, Cody knows this, Spears knows it, Jericho, that's going to be the most important thing of the show. You just can't throw two guys in a ring and say, hey, you guys got 25 minutes, go at it. Because they're not going to have that. I don't know how long the show every week is going to be, but you're going to have
It's a two-hour
show. 4 or 5-minute matches with intros.
Yeah. You mentioned something in your answer there that has always just rang in my head for as long as I've been in the business. Less is more. I want to read you a quote from Chris Jericho's podcast this past week, and he stated that Kenny Omega and Pac were both upset that they ran out of time, that they didn't get to do everything they wanted to do in the 23 minutes that they were out in the ring for their match at All Out. This was something that I really, really scratched my head over. You had more planned than 23 minutes?
Yeah. I met Pac a couple times. Super nice kid, ultra talented. same with Kenny. Definitely, but I would say this, I don't think either one of those guys, they're used to going 30, 35, 40 minutes. They just are. If you look at most of their matches, that's how they go. And I would think that they are their own hardest critics. Nobody's going to come down on them harder than themselves. And they're perfectionists in their art. I think each one of them, how do I put it? Each one of them definitely views professional wrestling as an art form And when they're out there, they're artists and they're performing their presentation to the people, which is a whole other thing we can get into, because that's where I think most of modern wrestling is going to. I just do. I think the battle of good and evil is not going to be portrayed by a lot of the talents in wrestling today. I think they'd rather put on a performance and present it to the fans. But Kenny and Pac are just so set in that mindset. They're so intense, and they want to have such a great outing out there that if it falls short of expectation, whether it's crowd response or time that they had to hit or whatever, they're going to come down to themselves and say, hey, look, you know, to the – I mean, hell, we both sat – and I watched wrestlers who were world-class performers go out in the ring and get mad because they blew a spot. And then after the match is over, they'd be in the back doing squats to punish themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the rest of us would be like, what?
Yeah.
What is he talking about? That was incredible out there. So I would chalk it up to that. Just Kenny and Pac being the ultimate perfectionists, and they strive for their craft. They sacrificed. Well, both of them did. Both of them walked away from WWE. Kenny did and Pac did. Remember?
I do.
So that's but great young talents you can build around. Class act as guys. Don't know if I'll ever cross paths with either one of them again, but if I would, I'd shake their hand and say, hey, man, this is your ball now, guys. Run with it and just keep killing it. So,
last question for you on AEW. Very rarely is Vince McMahon available to the media, certainly not after every show. What do you make of Tony Khan? Is there a part of you that thinks maybe this is just a hey, look at me thing? Or do you believe Tony really has the mindset in place to make this a profitable money-making brand, leaving aside his own fandom?
The fans are going to determine whether or not this is a money-making brand. We don't know the inner workings of the deals behind the scenes. The original The original version of what this is supposed to be, originally, I would say, definitely has a business plan in place from what I heard, and it's being approached as such. Tony Khan was a fan. Tony Khan sat in the crowd at ECW. I know this firsthand because people were there with him and told me about it when I first started hearing about this 2 years ago. So I do think the intent is there. They're just not going to write checks left and right and just start paying this guy and that guy and him and her, and I think they want to do it. Again, if it succeeds, I don't know. I would assume that the company will lose money probably the first year or two, if not, I don't know. I mean, ventures do. TNA did for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
ECW lost money. But I don't know. I don't know what the end goal of it is. If it's to promote great wrestling shows and have a viable source of work for the boys, and it's awesome. I mean, hopefully they do make some money. I mean, I know some of the boys are going to make nice checks out of it.
Sure.
And then Tony himself is a fan, and this is what he wants to do. So
let's jump into some ECW. Now, all these years later, ECW is still held in very high regard by some fans. And, you know, there's companies like Ring of Honor and Impact who have been around, think about this, more than double the time ECW was in business, but still have not made the splash or mark on the industry ECW did. Is that an indictment on those companies or a testament to ECW?
It's both. I would say, here's ECW's hot period was 93, 94 to like, I'll say 2000, 2001. So you're right, 6 or 7 years it was around. And it burned bright. And when it ended, it's still talked about in legend almost 20 years later. When was the last time you saw a wrestling show and people started chanting, WCW, WCW?
Never.
They don't. Never. ECW was, and now it's grown in legend because the fans of today, the wrestling fans, they're hearing from their uncle, aunt, their dad, their brother. Oh, man, you should have seen that ECW back then. Like, what? Like, when I first was in the business at Mike Sharp's and then had Stevie was at ECW and a couple other guys, and I would hear about it, and I'd see it on MSG. And then when I first went to the show for the first time, I'll never forget it. I went to my buddy, Rocco Dorsey. We went to Stevie, got his tickets. We go to the show. We're sitting there watching it. And before the show started, John Bailey, Hat Guy, hope he's feeling better. He just went through it a little bit. But Hat Guy was making his way to his seat, and he pulled out. The crowd started chanting, "Where's your hat?" And he pulled out the hat, and 1,500 people lost their mind.
Right.
And I looked at Rocco Dorsey. I said, this can't be real. It felt like I was at the Kumite. like an underground fight that you weren't supposed to be at. And then, you know, to be brought on board and be part of it was obviously incredible. But I just think that a lot of people have tried to recapture that. And I would say that ECW, here's the thing too, Canyon said this, God rest his soul, Canyon said this to me one time. And he said, Nova, we were in the business during the greatest period ever of the wrestling business. I said, what do you mean, Chris? He said, from the early 90s to 2000, 2001, bro, every company was running, every company was selling out, everybody was making money, and you could go anywhere. I said, huh, you're absolutely right, Chris.
I was 10 years too late.
Right. I mean, it was incredible. Everybody was printing money, and it was an amazing time to be in the industry. I loved it. It was great. I just think it was the right place, right time, with the right group of guys, and we just struck gold. And people have tried to recapture that several times, and it just never seems to work.
Now, we've all heard the story. We've heard everybody's account, you know, everybody that you can possibly think of. But from the perspective of Nova, take me through the final days. When did you know it was the end? When did you start piecing together a fallback plan for what was ahead?
I like to think I was pretty clear-headed during all this, too, because I was never really so messed up, whether it be, you know, physically or chemically. I have a pretty good recollection of most of this. I started getting the feeling like when people started leaving for WCW, WWF, and guys started not wanting to sign long-term deals, and you could just see, you know, one check being missed into two checks, and then pay-per-view bonuses weren't coming in. Just a lot of little things like that started adding up, and you just kind of kept thinking, man, I hope this works out. But in the back of your head, you always had a fallback plan. I mean, I know I did. I just started training harder and getting better shape and say, all right, well, if ECW goes out of business, I'll just go west and wrestle wherever until I get signed somewhere. That was the goal. I mean, I never looked at it and said, man, you know, this is awful or this or that. Or I mean, it sucked because when it went out of business, we were like, wow, You know, there goes something we just put the last 5 years of our life to. But I would say probably a year beforehand, before the final bell tolled, I would say a year beforehand, I started saying, man, I don't think this is going to work. Not that we didn't want it to. Don't get me wrong. We were all hoping it was going to. But you're not an idiot either, you know. You're not going to be like, well, you know, kind of figured something was up.
Had the company not closed, where was Nova headed?
I was going to be the next TV champion. Me and C.W. Anderson were going to – that's out of the mouth of Tommy. And even I think Paul said that one time too. But me and C.W. Anderson, I had come full circle on the last pay-per-view. Came running out, new look, jacked to the gills, busted my ass to get in shape. The fans had really taken to me. I had went from a comedy wrestler with Raven's group to somebody that could, at that time, I'd like to think, maybe go toe-to-toe with anybody who was out there. So I would have got a TV title run. That would have been cool. Me and CW talked about that a few times. That would have been cool to do that. But, you know, that's not how it worked.
Talk about your relationship with Paul here in ECW. Everyone knows Paul is the creative genius and the man behind ECW, but talk about your relationship with him in ECW and how that would change once you both got to WWE.
I mean, here's the thing. I've dwelled on this over the years. I'm not going to bury Paul. I'm not going to hate Paul. I'm not going to do this. What I'm going to say is Paul Heyman was a wrestling promoter. Good or bad, whatever it is, he's a wrestling promoter. That's what Paul is. That's what Paul was. That's what he still is, no matter if he's an advocate or he's still a wrestling guy. And he's obviously one of the smartest people who's ever been in the wrestling business because he's never went without a check. I mean, he lost money, though, too. I mean, when ECW went out of business, he borrowed, you know, I think money from his parents and his own money and this and that, and it wasn't a joyride. I mean, I've not said over the years, man, I disagree with a lot of things I might have heard or been part of, but for Paul, ECW was a big part of his life. You know, he was up there in everything. Everything was ECW was him and a bunch of other people, too, helping, but you know what I mean? I mean, he was his baby and his child, and he grew, and I think the last thing that he wanted to do was see it go under and be destroyed.
Right.
But relationship wise, I never really had one. Paul was the booker. He was the promoter. I was cool. He was a booker who had wrestling shows, and I was the guy who wrestled. I kept it at that. I didn't hang out afterwards. I didn't drink. I didn't really fit in. I did my own thing. And even years later in WWE, it was always like, hey, what's up, Paul? That's pretty much about it.
You mentioned doing your own thing right there. And that kind of brings me to my next question. For my money, Nova was one of the most over babyfaces ever in ECW. Why do you think you were able to connect with the ECW fans so well?
Easy. That's the easiest question you've asked me yet. Because I was one of them. Because I sat in the crowd. Because I went to Iron Mike Sharp's wrestling school. Because I knew the people in the audience. They saw me. I associated them. I gave autographs. I was super cool with everybody. And they respected it. That was the generation, the birth of the smart fans. So they had got to see you and how you came up with your craft and how you got better. And they got to see your matches and then watch. They took the journey with you. That's one of the biggest. With the ECW fans, I always felt like they felt they took the journey with me. And that last pay-per-view, come running out and doing everything, I think like that was like the payoff. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like they got to see like, wow, man, he really did it. So, but yeah, that's exactly why. Because I never put myself above the fans. To this day, I don't. The fans are the reason we had jobs. A lot of people forget that. If it wasn't for wrestling fans, there's no reason we'd do a wrestling show. Simple as that. I love the fans. You know, they made me a lot of money. Made me live my dream. Had a great time, and a great time doing it. Still to this day, when I see fans at convention or whatever it may be, I'll sit and talk to them and hang out and give them everything I got. That's what we did.
I want to quickly, before we wrap up ECW, I want to quickly touch on the BWO, because 23 years later, the BWO is still extremely relevant, no pun intended. Why 23 years later is the BWO still relevant?
I don't know, man. You know, I think that's one of those things where the fans, it's another thing the fans made. That was supposed to be a one-night gig. One night. That's all it was supposed to be. And then because we had done Kiss and we were trying to think of things to do differently. So we rocked out BWO. And the next thing I know, we're wearing it again and again and again. It just started selling. It's one of the best-selling T-shirts probably ever in wrestling. I mean, I'll say it. Definitely in ECW. And we just crushed it across the board. And I think the fans saw it. And the fans, I think, said to themselves, you know what? This is ours. This is our thing. And they just took to us. And, again, we were on a – it's crazy that it's remembered as fond as it is, because if we were on, like, the what was it? The Greatest Factions DVD by WWE and a couple other things. We just, all three of us have signed to do Retromania, the new video game coming out next year. I showed you that, didn't I?
You did, yep.
Yeah. We're going to do Retromania. I mean, so there's a nostalgia factor to it, but the fans absolutely loved it. And we still, it's very rare the three of us get together. We'll do some appearances next year for that. But, yeah, man, that was lightning in a bottle. You know, we caught it. We lucked out with it. And it's, again, every time, you know, and then I'll see like another faction or a group or a thing or something. And I'm like, I don't know, man. You can't. Plus, it worked too, because me and Stevie all got along so well. The fans saw it. When the fans see you as a talent having fun and really invested in what you're doing, it works. When you're going through the motions and it looks painful and you look like you're at a job, then they're just turned off by it, you know? That's why guys like Eugene work so well. Santino Morella works so well. Like those kind of guys, you can tell they put so much energy and time and effort into it. The fans are like, wow, man, that's awesome. They did that for us. So that's why I think the BWO worked.
We're going to jump into some WWE here real quick before we start to wind down. But before we do that, I need you to tell me the story about when you came face-to-face with Hulk Hogan while in your Hollywood Nova gear.
Man, that was a Great American Bash. It was the year that Shawn Michaels wrestled Hogan, and we're wrestling the Mexicools on that. So I'm in the back, put all our stuff on, and I had avoided him like the plague all day long. Because he knew, you know, I knew he knew that I did it and this and that, but it's totally different, like, knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, he's there in the building. And, like, even a couple people had said to me, hey, man, you got to, I was like, no, you know, I just want to get this done and not say anything about it. So I'm in full gimmick, dude. the makeup, the boas, the whole thing. And I just go walking into the side room. It had no sign on it, no nothing. And I go walking into this room, and there he was right there. And I just looked at him. I said, "Hey, Hulk, how you doing?" He goes, "Good look, brother." I was like, "Well, you know, I tried." He goes, "Nah, man, it's great. Keep going, brother." I was like, "All right, cool." And I walked out like 2 minutes later. To this day, Keenan, I've told you this too, I kick myself in the ass that I didn't run over and grab somebody and say, "Hey, can you get a photo of us together?"
Absolutely. That would have been the most epic picture. And yeah, how do you not regret that?
Well, I regret it to a degree, but you and I know exactly why I didn't.
I know.
Because
could you imagine?
Could you imagine if I had walked out there, and if any certain individual has saw me, "What are you doing taking a picture of Hulk?" I never would have heard the end of it.
A certain former WWE champion standing right outside
and
the door.
And this is anybody. It could have been anybody. It could have been 20 guys that would have walked by and said something about it. Or not then. They would have bitched about it or harped on it. It was just, trust me, if you're a young talent listening to this now, and you're in WWE, behind the scenes, whatever, you have no clue of what Bizarro World was like all those years ago.
Some was good, though.
I'm not going to bag on all of it, but there was so much more that I would leave a week of shows and just say, "Oh my God, I do not want to go back here."
All right, we're touching on WWE here a bit, so let's just get right into it. You know, everyone has a different story. They all have their own path of how they got there. Talk a little bit about how your talks got started with the company and how you found out you were eventually being brought in.
I was in ECW, got out of ECW, was wrestling all over the world, knew I'd wind up there eventually, did some shows out in California for Rick Bassman. That's where I met Frankie, doing a bunch of shows all over the place. And then Jim Ross literally told me, "We're going to get to you as soon as we can. Just keep doing your thing." That's when WCW went out of business, and they had just brought a whole bunch of people to HWA through there. So I said, "Okay, Jim, no problem." Just started wrestling, doing my thing.
But at this time, you're booked all over the place. I mean, you're all over the world.
I was booked everywhere.
There's
dude.
No lack of work.
Japan, Germany, Mexico. I was everywhere. And finally, I get a call one day. "Hey, we want to give you a shot." And I was like, "All right, like a tryout?" They said, "No, we just want to give you a shot." And I said, "Okay." Jim Cornette called me about a week later. I saw Jimmy too at Dennis Carluzzo's funeral in Jersey. And he had said to me, Hey man, just keep doing your thing. We're going to get you." I said, "Okay." He goes, "I want to bring you down to OVW." I said, "Okay." And then a couple weeks later, I was doing mocap out in California with Frankie. Johnny Ace called and said, "Hey, you want to come work for WB?" I said, "Yeah. I got to finish a tour of Japan and Australia first. As soon as I get back, I'm good." And that was it. That's how I got in.
So you finish up all of your commitments. You finish up Japan. You finish up Australia. Signed by the company. Come into OVW. First night in. Beat John Cena for the OVW heavyweight title. Talk to me a little bit about John back then and how he may have changed over the years, for better or for worse.
I don't know. You know, here's the thing. John Cena... forever, good, bad, indifferent to anybody else, I will tell you this. For me, John Cena will always be the prototype who let me and the Blue Meanie sleep in his furnitureless apartment because he was such a minimalist when we had nowhere to stay in UPW and we were cool with the guy. I came down here. John was finishing up. John had a couple weeks left when I first got here, and he finished up. He was gone.
He was on his way up to the main roster?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I haven't watched the show a whole lot over the last couple of years, but I think John's done okay for himself.
Yeah.
I might be wrong.
I think he's carved a space out in the business.
John's work ethic was second to none. The schedule that he endured as champion was unlike no other, because a lot of the other guys, when they had the runs that John had, they quite simply said no to a lot of the stuff that John's like, "Well, I'll go do it."
Right.
And to see him parlay into acting and all this other stuff, that was great. You know, I like John Cena. I always liked John. He was a good talent in the ring. I enjoyed wrestling him. He was a cool guy to be around. That's another one, too. Every now and then somebody will say, "Oh, John's this or John." I haven't laid eyes on John Cena in 10 years.
Same.
Don't even know if he'd recognize me if I saw him today. But if he did, I'd say, "Hey, John, I wish you all the best, man." You know?
Same thing. He always treated me like a pro. John was always straight up. You know, told me what I did right, but told me what I did wrong. You know, there's... He was always a pro to work with, just a, a top guy. But a couple seconds ago, you mentioned Jim Cornette. And around this time, you know, OVW really was the place to be. And the Jim Cornette we all know now, I'm sure was the same way, but to a lesser degree back then. Talk a little bit about your memories of working with Corny. And how did he help you become a better performer?
Well, most of what I've done in the ring, I can attribute to, I learned how to work very hard in ECW, and I learned how to work very smart in OVW. And that was through mostly Danny Davis and Rip Rogers. Jimmy would do TV. He'd work on our promos and help us out. But Jimmy, Danny, Rip, all of them together, and also getting all the reps. I was the first one to practice every day and one of the last ones to leave. So I couldn't get enough of it because for me, I was getting paid $1,000 a week just to wrestle and work out. Oh, my God. I'm a millionaire. This is the greatest thing I was ever part of. That was my personal contract I had down there. And then you get bumped up from there. But, you know, just being in the OVW environment and working and training and being part of the system, I got better through that and trial and error. You know, Jimmy's Jimmy. I don't talk to him anymore these days. He just is on the complete end of the spectrum of most rational human beings. I wish him no ill will. If he crossed paths with me again and I see him, hey, Jim, what's up? And just keep walking right by. I wish him all the best and whatever him and Sin do and their whatever they do. I don't know. I don't know what they do. But, you know, back then in that time, it was a good gig, man. He wrote me, he always treated me fairly. He treated me like a top guy from the minute I got there until the minute I left OVW. So I have no bad feelings about it.
So at this time, you're in OVW. You've been there a while. You're doing the Jersey Shore crew deal with Ido and Inferno. But are you getting frustrated at all? Because before you came in there, you were this big star, and you're there some 2 years later. Is that starting to wear on you a bit?
I got frustrated because I didn't understand why it was taking so long. And there was just no connection. There was no communication. The developmental system as a whole was broken to a degree, I always thought. And then, you know, to go in there and I hate to say, because there was a lot of good guys down there, but I thought that if I wasn't the best in-ring talent at that time, there I was certainly amongst the top four or five. And you see guys get called up and here and there and whatnot, and you're kind of sitting back and saying to yourself, man, what else do I have to do? I would pitch ideas and try to get called up, whatnot, and just never seem to work. Until finally, and it was getting aggravated. They actually approached me about me being a trainer down there, actually. Before Lance and Al came on board. And I was like, all right, because I just got tired of getting bumped out every day. And, you know, it's great to be down there training, but you can't wrestling in a school and training, it's not working. Anyone who tells you that's working is lying to you. That's training. Working is being in front of people, listening to crowds, learning your timing, and learning for you what works and what doesn't work. So that's not what you do when you train. So, yeah, it got aggravating, but, you know, eventually it all worked out.
Talk to me a little bit about the origin of Simon Dean. It's something so far away from anything else you've done.
Well, I always had several ideas in my mind of a character. You see, here, if you're sitting out there right now, and let me give you some free advice. You don't have to pay for the seminar for this. Give you some advice. So you're a talent out there right now. You're going to get a chance to go to WWE one day. To be an extra, to do TV, brother. So if you go there, if you don't go there with ideas, packets, photographs, different outfits, ideas for characters, if you go there without any of that, you're a complete dipshit and you're wasting your time. The WWE has so many people on the radar that will quote unquote do whatever you ask me to do. I never wanted to be one of those guys. So you have to have ideas. You have to have a shot. You have to have characters, gimmicks, promo, something about you that makes you different. You just can't be the next door neighbor. Nobody's going to care about that. So have something that you can give them to work with. So I always had this idea in my head. And I was on the road one weekend, and Johnny came over and said, hey, you're going to meet with Vince today. He wants to come up with some ideas of how to get you on the road. I said, okay. So I meet with Vince. We sit and talk, and he said, what's your, you know, you've been a great talent in the ring. I definitely think we could do something with you. What's your idea? Just come out of his mouth. What's your idea? Now, I could have said, well, I'll do whatever you need me to do, boss. You know, I'm just happy to be here. Okay, great. Next. But instead, I said, hey, I want to be like a fitness guy. I told him like Jack LaLanne, Tony Little, and I want to have a system, this whole thing. I wanted to be Sonny Slade. That was the name I thought of. I wanted to have Sonny Slade's super system of self-help and supplements. That was the angle. So I tell him this whole thing, and he's like, man, this is incredible. We'll shoot some vignettes for this. And I said, no, I want to do infomercials. And he was like, this is incredible. So we just started talking about it. You know, long so fast forward, the whole thing with when they came to OVW, and Vince only came to OVW one time ever. They came down with the writers, didn't tell anybody I was going to do it. I put a match together with Aaron Aguilera. At the end of the day, I presented the character, did the promos, the whole deal. 3 weeks later, I'm up in Stanford shooting infomercials. And it went from there. You know, I've always believed in trying to control my own destiny and my own fate, whether it's in wrestling or life or whatever it may be. If you're going to let somebody else do that for you, man, then you're just a passenger and you're just wasting your time.
So the old man's a fan. He's a, you know, he's a huge supporter of Simon Dean from the outset. Simon Dean's on the main roster, getting tons of heat, working with top guys, having great matches. Why was the direction of the character never taken to a higher level?
Because I never had anybody in my corner, and I never had anybody speaking for me before I got there. When you go to, and you know this, Keenan, when you go to the WWE and you get a shot, you are what you are the first day that you're perceived as such, and it will never change.
God, it's so true.
And I just had people there who didn't believe in me, didn't want to give me a shot. Every time I kept excelling or trying to move it forward, it would probably burn their ass a little bit. And they were salivating, just snapping at the chops, waiting to beat me, too. Like, I think I was there for about 4 or 5 months doing the sponsorship thing, and I was wrestling matches, and I was beating a few underneath people. And, you know, DQs and stuff like that. And I'll never forget it. We got back from the pay-per-view in Puerto Rico, and we were doing a Sunday Night Heat. I was undefeated at this point. And I won't say who they are, because I don't even think about these people anymore. But he comes running up to me, goes, hey, guess what? You're losing tonight. This is somebody who's in the creative department. Hey, guess what? You're losing tonight. And I go, huh? Yeah, you haven't been beaten yet, but guess what? It ends tonight. I go, okay, cool. And then, like, from that moment on, I never won another match, ever. I guess it was, you know, local on Velocity or something. I would say to them every couple months, laughingly, I'd say, hey, I just want to let you know, you guys keep telling me what great matches I'm having out there. If I actually win every now and then, I might get a little bit more credibility. So when I wrestle somebody a little higher on the card, people might actually believe my false finishes. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, no problem. Yeah, so I was like, huh, okay.
Yeah, but you're speaking pig Latin to these people.
I'm not saying gave up, but I knew the gig. You and I talked about it countless times. I used to call them mortgage matches and be like, well, I'm just going to pay my mortgage with this, and that is what it is. So, you know, you just become disenfranchised with it, and all you can control is wrestling is your look, your ability, and your attitude in the ring. And that's it. Anything else is just like, oh, okay. And it doesn't really matter. So
I'm almost
I knew the gig.
I'm almost positive I know the answer to this, but I want to see if I'm right. What was your career highlight as Simon Dean?
Oh, you know it. God, what do you think it is? Tell me.
I think it's the segment that should have been on WrestleMania the night before. However,
100%.
It was on Monday Night Raw when you and Maven tried to sell the Simon system to Stone Cold Steve Austin.
100%. That's exactly what it was. It was a career high point. It was validation for me. It really let me know that I made it. When we walked back, for those of you who didn't see it, just go type on YouTube, Simon Dean, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Super, the coolest guy, easy ever to work with, super awesome to us. No rehearsal on that at all. We didn't know what we were going to say or do. We knew it was going to end with me and Maven eating stunners, but we had no idea how it was going to get to that point. And they gave us an uncapped time, too. Let's just go out there and you guys just do what you think. Let's see. Okay, no problem. And it couldn't have been any better. I felt so good about that because it was cool, too, when I walked in the back. Pat Patterson looked right at me. And Pat said, that should have been on WrestleMania last mm-hmm. night. And I looked right at him. I said, yeah, I would have made about another $10,000 on it if it was. And he just started laughing. But again, I still did it. Like, it can't be erased. So whether it was on WrestleMania or on that or whatever, you can see that. You can't fool a fan. Like, a fan can go back and watch that and say to themselves, wow, that was great. Like, I was entertained by that. So it's the product that you're putting out there as a talent. Whether WWE chooses to use that or not, it's on them. That's the asset I was giving them. If they chose to run with it, they run with it. If not, then it's a wasted asset. So
you make the transition in into talent relations about two and a half years into your run on the main roster. How are you approached about moving out of the ring and into talent relations, and how did you feel about it?
Tommy wanted out. They were going to relaunch ECW. They had no desire to do it. Vince McMahon and Johnny Ace both asked me about it. I had been around the block. I'd, you know, been around a bunch of systems. I was college educated. I was, intelligent. I kind of knew from both sides of, you know, trying to make it and then quote unquote making it. I'd be an advocate for the guys. And I knew the character wasn't going anywhere. I couldn't stand going on the road each week. I grew to, hey, you know all this because you were with me. But I hated it. So I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. If nothing else, I knew there's no way it was going to last long term. Whether it lasted a year, 2 years, 5 years, there was never a single time, Keenan, and I've told you this many times, in my lifetime when I was in WWE, that I ever viewed myself as a lifer, ever. Because there was no way I was going to be able to amalgamate myself enough into the environment to truly digest and just live in that bubble. And I couldn't. I would have went crazy. I would have killed somebody for sure. There's no way I wouldn't have snapped and killed somebody.
I remember some of the phone calls.
Yeah, I would have.
You mentioned John Laurinaitis a couple seconds ago. Someone you've always spoken very highly of. Johnny's always someone who's done right by me. I love Johnny. What are some things that John taught you about working in the office, as he was one of the boys at a point in time as well?
He told me, Mike, don't sell. And this is what used to get me in trouble, because I would sell. Like, I wear my heart on my sleeve, man. And I had to. I was going into that thinking I'm cool with all these guys. These are my buddies. Keenan, 99% of them turned out to be piece of shit scumbags. A lot of these guys were guys I knew for years, man. Came up with them, knew them, wrestled, all this stuff. And the minute, see, you know this. Everybody in wrestling wants you to do good, but they don't want you to do better than they are.
Correct.
And the minute that happens, you become a scourge. You become this, you become that. And I would get emotional about it, man. I mean, this shit plays with your head. Oh, my God. You know, I used to sit up at night being upset about it. And then Johnny used to tell me, I'm not friends with any of these people. I don't sell these people. He was cool with them and cordial, but they weren't over his house. They didn't come to his kids' birthday parties. He didn't call them to see how they were doing on Christmas Day. Like, he was just able to separate it.
It was a job for Johnny.
And even to this day now, like, I have great employees and then a bunch of other work, but I'm not super close to a lot of people just in the workforce. I'm just not. And it just works. That's how I am. You know, I have great friends and great people I'm around, but just in the wrestling industry, you just can't have that. You know, I know everybody wants to think that they're not. Anybody who's listening to this right now and you're in WWE, wait until you quit. Wait until you quit or you leave the company or something happens. Wait to see how many people call you a month, 2 months, 6 months down the road. You won't hear from anybody. You won't. Until they get released or fired or something happens, then they want to call you
because they
need
something.
You did to get booked so they can try to get the heat.
Correct. So. Couple more things. June 27th, 2007, I'm sure it's a date that rings to you. It's a day I'll never forget. As an executive in the company and having to handle talent such as myself at the time, can you take me through this day and when you started to find out about the Chris Benoit tragedy and what your next steps were?
If I'm not mistaken, I think I was down in Georgia because I'm pretty sure Sherry Martel died around this same time. And I think I went to her funeral and was coming back or something. Or I was down in Florida. I went from Georgia to Florida or something. Somehow I wound up down in Florida. And I got the call and said, hey, Mike, I just want to let you know what happened. And Johnny told me I was with Joe Gomez. And I looked at Joe and I told him. And Joe's like, what happened? I said, I don't know. They found him dead. The whole family's dead. It didn't cross my mind for several hours until I was with Christian. I was at Christian's house. And he was in TNA at the time. And we were watching Raw. And Christian said right to me, and I think he's talked about this before, Christian. I could be wrong, because I love Peeps. Great guy. So I don't want to out him.
Shout out to Peeps.
You know, I doubt he is. But he looked at me after they did the Raw tribute, and he said, I think they just eulogized a murderer. And I said, you think what? It never crossed my mind. And he's like, it doesn't make sense. So we started thinking, and people started calling each other and whatnot, and then the theory started coming out, and all the information came out. I was like, oh, my God, there's no way. And then looking back, do I think he – I mean, I'm not going to give my opinion on it. Because none of us can say what happened.
Right.
I just think that it was a horrendous tragedy that black marked wrestling forever. It took the life of Nancy and Daniel, and they were incredible. And Chris, when Chris was around that kid, he was awesome as a dad and the most intense in-ring competitor I've ever been in the ring with. I loved wrestling him. But I can't speak on anything other than that because I'd have to sit here and tell you he's the worst human being who ever lived because I can't look at that through rose-colored wrestling glasses. Like, I have to look at that for what it is. I mean, if Jeffrey Dahmer was a great guy and everybody loved him and he worked really hard at his job and we all was like, man, he's fantastic. He's going to go into the Hall of Fame one day at this, you know, kitchen cleaner job, whatever it may be. Like, I don't know. Sometimes we get confused in wrestling and we look at people differently because they were like great workers or they were amazing stars. And same in Hollywood. We have to look at those people differently than we do in people in the real world. And I'm not always sure why we do that.
Yeah, I remember that day just like it was yesterday. You actually woke me up from a nap. My phone rang. It said Nova on my caller ID. And you said, and I remember just like it was yesterday, you told me, hey, man, here's the deal. Chris Benoit's dead. And... if any media tries to talk to you about anything, you don't know anything. So that,
you were like, what?
I sat and watched Raw just like yeah. Everybody else. But a couple more things here. Who was a talent? And I think I know this answer as well. And if not, I'll give you mine. But who was a talent that you had under your time as director of developmental that you looked at and just said, this guy is a WrestleMania moment waiting to happen, and
Daniel Roadheimer,
and it never panned out. Yep, and he's mine as well.
Daniel Roadheimer, Mike Bucci. Don't know if he'll listen to it. Tag him in this. Send him a message.
Tell him I put him
over. Great guy, 6-something, blonde. He was like a version of Gronk.
Yeah.
He was like Gronk before Gronk. Isn't that a great comparison?
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah, Gronk before Gronk, and he was the big deal. I don't know
where that went south personality.
Or what happened, but he was a great guy to be around, great energy, good athlete, good-looking kid, could talk. I don't know what happened. They just got rid of it. I don't know.
Well, he may be representing the state of Nevada in Congress.
I hope he does. Great talent, great kid, man. I love Dan. There were very few people in developmental who drove me nuts. There was a lot of them who I wouldn't say I either liked or disliked. I just didn't give a shit about them. Because once I started taking the Johnny approach on it and just trying to make them names and numbers, there's a whole bunch of you guys who I looked after. I mean, hell, Paul Burchill was going to get fired the first day I was there. I said, not today. We were able to keep him for another couple years. You know that. He knows it too.
He got several more years out of that run.
Yeah, there was a bunch of people there who I just felt like once they, and I would tell you this now, if you're in the developmental system, if you're listening to this, if you are in NXT or the developmental system, you have not made it. You have made it to that certain point. Now you have to set the next goal for yourself. You know, now that NXT is going to be on USA, could be a little different, the mindset, I don't know, but I constantly wanted to get a little bit more for myself. So we shall see.
Well, I couldn't do this interview without asking, because your name did come into the media just last week, believe it or not.
Which is bizarre, but go ahead.
By and large, you've been out of the spotlight for, you know, 10, 12 years. But former WWE champion, CM Punk, who did an appearance at StarCast in Chicago, being interviewed by our good friend Mike Johnson, was asked about an incident that took place with Tony Atlas while in OVW. Atlas, of course, was a guest trainer there for the week, and Punk, who was ECW champion at the time, came back and did a special appearance for us and ended up getting into an altercation with Tony, which ended up in a shouting match in our post-show meeting. I was sitting right there. I was sitting next to Paul Burchill. Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder were right in front of us. And Punk made a mention, Punk said last week, rather, Nova couldn't wait to run to tell the office about this. Funny thing about this is You weren't even there. You weren't in the state of Kentucky. After all of these years, what do you think prompted Punk to make such a remark?
I will say this. Phillip Brooks has always lived in his own world, good or bad. It's given him the edge to accomplish what he's wanted to accomplish in life, but it's also made him come up with verbose statements like that. I didn't believe it when you told me. You texted me, and you said, hey, check this out, bro.
I couldn't believe it when I read it.
And I had to call you up, and I said, this can't be real. And you're like, no, it is, dude. He name-dropped you at his – I said, hold on a minute. This guy, who's one of the most enigmatic, if that's how you say the word, guys of the last decade, strange brew kind of fellow, does his own thing. Finally, they drag him out of the mothballs to do an interview, and my name is going to come out of his mouth about the head of the vote. Okay, so I get that. So I text Mike. I'm like, Mike. Mike's like, no. I said I liked you. I didn't. I said, no, no heat on you, Mike. But did this guy really say this? He's like, yeah. So then I see it in print on the internet. Now, again, if you're listening to this, this is where every single syllable that came out of Phillip's mouth after this has to be proven as not only a lie, but a complete made-up fantasy. The man stated that I couldn't wait to Nova couldn't wait to the office, and that I and Al Snow tried to fire him and the Major Brothers. That's out of his mouth. This is not fictitious. This is not 5 years down the road. The man said it 2 weeks ago. You can go look at it. Go look at it online. Those words came out of CM Punk Phillip Brooks' mouth. And again, I'm going to preface this. I don't like Punk. I don't dislike Punk. I have no feeling towards Punk at all.
You're indifferent
to Punk. The guy who pumped my gas today at Shell when I was inside paying for it, he meant more to me today than probably CM Punk ever did. That's just a fact of reality. We had a couple mutual friends. We never hung out. We didn't interact. That's it. I was never Punk's boss. Let me let you in for a shock, guys. CM Punk never had a boss, except for Vince McMahon. When he was on the Independence, he was his own boss. When he was in Ian Rotten's, he booked his own shit, and he was his own boss. When he was at Ring of Honor, he was his own boss. He answered to no one. He did his own angles. I'm sure Gabe and Rob and all the other guys will tell you different, but we all know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, how this works. And don't get me wrong, it worked for him because he did great stuff. When he was in the developmental system, Keenan, you were there. Did he have a boss?
Not to my knowledge.
No. You know what he did? He used to sit around with Paul and Albright and all the other guys who were actually showing that they wanted to learn more about the business. They were sitting around writing the TV show, making the signs for the fans to have in the audience to cheer this one or that one so that the WWE writers and the people behind the scenes would see all this stuff and say, wow, that person's really over, or that person has a lot of heat. Let's do something with them. I don't fault any of this. They saw the opportunity and took it. But I was never CM Punk's boss. It doesn't even make any sense. The whole Tony Atlas thing, when I've heard about this over and over again, and I've said, God, and they're like, yeah, you weren't even there, Nova. I wish I had been there, Keenan. Could you imagine how much I would have stopped it? If I had been there, because you can say whatever you want about Tony, I still respect him, and you know Punk has his views. He wasn't going to be silent. He can say his thing. But I would have tried to stop that however I could. Because I didn't find – was you who called me? Who called me the next day? You?
I don't think it was me. It could have been. I don't think it was, though.
Somebody did, and I was like, honestly,
I can't imagine it wasn't Danny Davis or Al Snow.
No, they definitely both called me, too. They both told me what happened. And I just remember saying, really, man? And then I saw Punk like a week later, and I just remember going up to him saying, really, dude, you had to get into it with Tony Atlas. You couldn't let it go. And he said, fuck Tony Atlas. I'm not letting nothing go. And I said, all right,
wow,
man. Never spoke to him again about it, ever. Never said a word. So not only you, the listener who's listening to this right now, not only was I not in the building, I couldn't go wait to tell the office. I was sitting in the office. Did I run to go call myself? It doesn't even make any sense when you listen to it.
You were the office.
And then the boomerang on that, the other part of it that's flying back right now, that myself and Al Snow couldn't wait to fire the Major Brothers. Kevin Keenan, did I not send you irrefutable proof from said Major Brothers that said, Nova, this never happened. You were great to us. You treated us like gold. You were there. Did you not see that with your own eyes?
You texted it to me the other day.
So, again, He's been, now I'm going to chalk this up. I'm going to give Phillip chalk on it. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Whole wrestling career, all those years, the beatings that he took in those UFC fights,
oof,
all that together, I'm going to say that he has a lapse in judgment, and he just forgot about it, and he has no idea what the true history was. I'm going to give him one up on that and say, hey, Phillip, do it over. I did reach out to one or two of his friends and say, hey, man, you might want to tell him to maybe revise this a little bit. And then I got the old wink, wink, brother, brother. Hey, man, I can't tell him. He's my friend. Sure, brother. No problem. Have a nice day. But it's one of those, you know. But I'm going to assume he has revisionist history. It's what he can live. I do not speak to Punk. I do not see Punk. I saw him. Let me take that back. I saw him at Matt Capitelli's funeral about a year ago. Walked right by him. Hey, Phillip, what's up? Hey, how you doing? Shook his hand. He had the, what's his name? The Deuce and Domino, Dice Clay guy. Yeah, he was with him. Hey, Clay, how you doing, man? Walked by, and that was it. Wouldn't care if I laid eyes on him again next year, 5 years, 10 years, wherever again in my life.
Well, it's very...
But to say in an interview that all that happened, I texted to Al. Al was like, what? Now, you got Al coming on this podcast tomorrow, right?
I do.
Wait till you ask Al the same question. But to the viewer, I would just say, when you read something on the internet, no matter whose mouth it comes out of, do a little research on it before you emotionally invest in what you just read and just throw it as blind gospel. Even if you're a follower of Punk or you wish he would come back or whatever it may be, he's a master psychologist. He's a master of hyperbole. Getting what he wants. I mean, if that's what this was, more kudos to him. I don't think it was. I just think he's so, I don't know, banged up or something that he just doesn't know what happened. That's my take on it. It's backed up by you. It's backed up by facts. I showed Mike Johnson the exact same stuff. And he said, huh, yeah, that's what I thought. So that's it.
Well, it's funny.
That's all I will speak on Phillip.
I wish I was treated half as badly in WWE as CM Punk was.
Yeah, it's odd, man. I just hope, like, whatever he's doing now in his life, I will say this. I hope he's happy. You know, since this incident occurred, I had a ton of people reach out to me and, like, vilify him, man. How much they hated him and this. And I said, guys, look, I'm not going for it. Like, I don't care what he does. But I hope he's happy living, like, with his wife and his life now outside of wrestling and whatever else he does with his days. I hope to God he never fights again. He was not prepared for that. I don't know how. The reason we got into pro wrestling is because you do an athletic performance of good versus evil and draw the fans in and try to capture imagination that way, so to speak. We forget, or I guess we believe our own press and say, hey, we can go there and do this. But 20 years ago, I would have trained for MMA because I would have liked the training part of it because I love training. I don't think I would have wanted to get hit in the face all the time. But because then I would have got angry, and then I would have had to fight angry instead of fight smart. So I just he had the hand of God placed on him wherever he went, though. Whether it was Ian Rotten's or Ring of Honor or the developmental system. I mean, for crying out loud, he debuted in the Manhattan Center against Justin Credible and jobbed him out in like 2 minutes. And from that point on, he never looked back. He printed money.
Yeah.
He was multiple champion of all these different belts and all these amazing main events and all this. He got to work manias. He got championship runs, merchandise, the pipe bomb thing. I mean, he got to script his own stuff in that. I mean, everything he got to do was incredible. There's a ton of guys out there that got treated way worse than he got. Could he have gotten more if he felt he earned it? Yeah, I guess if that's what he wanted and he pushed for that, that's awesome. But I hope that sometimes he takes a breath and realizes just what an amazing career he had.
Yeah, it's that's a lot to take in there, but it's actually amazing when you take a look at the landscape of CM Punk. Hey, man, last question. For years, you've always advocated for wrestlers to have a fallback plan and a way out of the business because, as we know, look, man, the bright lights don't last forever. As the years go on, are you finding that more and more guys are able to make that transition? Or do you think, to an extent, WWE should have something in place to get these guys ready should their contract run out, they get hurt, have nowhere else to go? Is it the responsibility of them since they reign king, or is that a personal choice?
I think it's a personal choice. But what I do think is this, and we'll wrap this up with this. Wrestling now is populated more than ever by people who are in it and training to be in it and performing at NXT or on the Indies or whatever it be. I think more than ever by people who are not necessarily lifelong fans of this. So by not being a lifelong fan, when you come in it and you're part of it, if you get cut or if you get released or you move on, whatever it may be, it'll be much easier for you to let go and then go move on to do whatever else you want to do in life. And you won't dwell on this for a year, 2 years, 5 years, waiting for the phone call or waiting for someone to reach out to you or whatever it is. You're not going to be so obsessed where you're going to be dreaming about this 24 hours a day anymore, because it's going to be like, hey, I gave this a shot. It didn't work out. It's time for me to move on. And I actually like that, because I don't think you'll see as much chemical dependency. You won't see as many like lives that are in ruin. You just won't see as many sad stories, I think, as you've seen maybe over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Like, I hope that my generation of guys, the early 90s, early late 90s, early 2000s, like, hope that's the last generation of like drug deaths and overdoses, like all that. And I hope the guys now are just a lot smarter with their money. They seem to be a lot smarter. They can collect their action figures. They can do their wrestling podcasts. They can play their video games. They can do all that stuff and not have to feel bad about it, because the majority of the roster does the same thing. And then there's a whole bunch of other people who are just kind of there because it looks like something cool to do. And if it doesn't work out, they go move on to something else. And that's fine, man. That's what this is now. Will some of the products suffer because of that? I think it could. But that's what society is today. There's a lot of actors today that are big stars that I don't think would have been big stars in the 90s or 2000s or the 80s. So it transforms and becomes something different.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.